Hi, welcome to Al-Muqaddimah. My name is Siavish. Europe and the Islamic world have been in contact with each other for as long as Islam has existed. This interaction has created some very interesting stories, from an Arabic-speaking pope to Muslim Vikings. Unfortunately, in popular media, this interaction between Europe and the Islamic world is too often shown in the colors of warfare. People will often talk about battles between a Muslim and a European empire as great religions colliding, but this is gross simplification of this complicated history. For instance, the Ottoman siege of Vienna in 1683 is often talked about by people with limited understanding of history as the great triumph of Christian Europe over the Islamic world. But did you know that in that siege, on the Christian side, there were several regiments of cavalry that were made up of almost entirely Muslims whose ancestors had lived in Europe since before the Ottoman Empire even existed. This is the story of the Tatars, the Muslim communities of Eastern Europe. This video is sponsored by Magellan TV. Magellan TV is a streaming service that hosts over 3,000 documentaries and shows in various genres, from history to science, as well as travel and art. They're adding new shows all the time, which you can enjoy on all sorts of devices. Also, best of all, there are no ads and an increasing percentage of shows is available in 4K with no additional cost. They were kind enough to offer Al-Muqaddimah viewers an extended free month-long trial. You can go to try.magellantv.com/Al-Muqaddimah to take advantage of that. Since you're watching a history channel, you might also like many historical documentaries that they have. One documentary that I really liked is called The Quran, Journey to the Book's Origin. It's an interesting documentary about the origins of the Quran. If anything, hopefully it'll inspire you to start your own research on the new facts about the origins of the Quran. Secondly, I'd recommend War and Wisdom, which brings forth an interesting comparison of Islam's Golden Age and the Crusades. It's a bit of a traditional narrative, but it's very informing nonetheless. Also, it starts with the flight of Ibn Firnas, the first documented attempt at human flight, so it's definitely worth checking out. Again, you can take advantage of a month-long free trial by clicking the link in the description. Back to the video. Tatar tribes were primarily nomadic and existed as early as the 5th and 6th centuries, when they stretched from Mongolia to Bulgaria. There was a time when everyone from east of the Tian Shan and north of the Himalayas was called Tatars. This included places like Tibet, Xinjiang, and Mongolia, but these are diverse places and Tatars only made up small portions of the population in these places. However, the modern term Tatars, especially in a Russian context, applies exclusively to the nomadic people who were conquered by the Mongols and later inherited by the Golden Horde, a Mongol successor Khanate. In fact, their divisions today largely resemble the territories of the Khanates that emerged after the fall of the Golden Horde. Before Genghis Khan's time, the Tatars in the east were divided by the Chinese emperors into white and black Tatars. To them, white Tatars were settled farmers who lived beyond the Great Wall, while the black Tatars were the nomadic Tatars who lived farther on the Mongolian steppes. They were united by Genghis Khan and consolidated into his military. In fact, Genghis Khan's birth name, Temujin, was borrowed by his father from a Tatar. It was also Tatars who had poisoned and killed Genghis Khan's father. During his lifetime, Genghis Khan conquered as far east as the northern edge of the Caspian Sea. After his death in 1227, his empire was divided by his sons. The westernmost part, known as the Golden Horde, was to go to his eldest Jochi, who had died, so it went to his sons Batu Khan and Orda Khan. While the empire was divided, the three Khans had to recognize the superiority of the Khakan, or Great Khan, back in the Mongol capital. The Khakan, after Genghis Khan, was his third son, Ogedai Khan. Batu proved worthy of being Genghis's successor. He took his empire from the northern edge of the Caspian, all the way to Vienna, which the Mongols were about to attack in 1241 when Batu Khan had to fall back due to Ogedai's death. He had reduced Ukraine, Hungary, and the Kievan Rus in the process, though his gains west of Ukraine were temporary. His capital was founded at Sarai, from where the Golden Horde would continue to rule for nearly three centuries. Batu died in 1255 and was briefly succeeded by two sons before his brother Berke Khan took over. Berke Khan was different than other Mongol princes because he was a Muslim. He had met a group of Muslim merchants in Bukhara whose faith he had been impressed by. By now, the Golden Horde itself had been divided into two, with the western part being called the Blue Horde and the eastern part being called the White Horde. Berke was the Khan of the Blue Horde. Different accounts tell us different stories about his impact on the Golden Horde. Some sources mention that he merely encouraged his subjects to convert to Islam, while some mention outright forceful conversions. Though it's difficult to estimate, but it's unlikely that a large population of the Blue Horde actually converted to Islam during Berke's 9 years as Khan. Berke was only the first of the Golden Horde's Muslim Khans. For example, his successor's successor, also known as his grand successor, was also a Muslim and a grandson of Batu Khan. While the Mongols didn't merge with the local settled populations that they had conquered, they did merge with the nomadic locals. Many of these tribes followed a similar lifestyle to the Mongols themselves, including aspects of their cultures and religions. Many of them were even Turkic and spoke a dialect of the Turkic language as their first or second language. Today, the term Tatar quite exclusively applies only to these people with whom the Mongols merged in the Golden Horde. The modern Republic of Tatarstan, located within Russia, is home to its largest population of Tatars. These Tatars are known as the Volga Tatars. They were the first of the people we now know as Tatars to convert to Islam. Around 921, the king of Volga Bulgaria converted to Islam. He then requested an embassy from the caliph at Baghdad to send him some scholars so he can learn more about Islam. This was the embassy that the famous Ibn Fadlan was a part of. Soon after that, a mosque was built in the capital. They even tried to convert Prince Vladimir the Great of Kiev, who rejected Islam over its prohibition on alcohol. The capital of the Volga Bulgar, known simply as Bulgar, seems to have been incorporated into the larger Islamic world due to its ties with the Caliphate at Baghdad. However, it was still, at least for the first century of its existence, an island of Islam in a sea of pagans and Christians. In 1223 or 1224, when Genghis Khan was busy with the Khwarizmian Empire, he sent his general, Jebe and Subutai, to attack the Volga Bulgars. The Volga Bulgars actually managed to ambush and defeat them. This was a time when the Mongols had a reputation for being invincible in battle. Though, with Batu Khan's invasion, Volga Bulgaria fell. Their capital was ruined, their population was massacred. As many as 80% of the people were either killed or relocated. Up to this point, however, the population of Volga Bulgaria didn't see themselves as one people. They saw themselves more as a confederation of the various tribes, but after the Mongol invasion, they began merging with the Mongols to form the Tatars. They also gave a lot of cultural traditions to the Mongols, which would remain with the Golden Horde for the duration of its existence. They began to gain influence under the Mongols, and a resurgence of Volga Bulgaria was seen, though this time less powerful but more cohesive. By the 1400s, the Golden Horde overlords had declined in power. A deposed Khan of the Golden Horde named Ulugh Muhammad conquered Kazan in 1438 and founded the independent Khanate of Kazan. The heartland of the Khanate back then forms the modern Republic of Tatarstan. The Khanate of Kazan developed a bloody rivalry with the Russian Principality of Moscow and began raiding them. In 1445, they were even able to capture the Grand Prince of Moscow, Vasily II, whom they ransomed. Later on, Grand Prince Ivan III of Moscow took a special interest in Kazan when he tried to install his ally, Khan Qasim of Kasimov, as the Khan of Kazan. This sparked the Russo-Kazan War, which, after 2 years, resulted in a Muscovite army besieging Kazan in 1469. From then to around 1500, there was strong Muscovite control on Kazan, which resulted in factions appearing in the Khanate to resist the puppet kings of Moscow. When Grand Prince Ivan III died in 1505, Kazan was able to bounce back under Khan Muhammad Amin. He pushed back against the Russians and was able to deliver a massive defeat, but decided to sue for peace. After his death, Moscow's puppets were once again on the throne. In 1521, the Khanate of Kazan allied with the Khanate of Crimea and besieged Moscow. They were so successful that the Grand Prince of Moscow had to sue for peace and pay tribute to the Crimean Tatars. This success put a huge target on Kazan's back. Kazan was besieged again, but not many permanent gains were achieved for 3 decades. That is, until the reign of Grand Prince Ivan IV, or Ivan the Terrible. In 1552, Ivan attacked Kazan with 150,000 soldiers. The city walls were destroyed. The city was taken. The Khanate of Kazan was dismantled. Ivan wanted to make it Russian in every way and form. He built a Kremlin, or citadel, in the city in the Russian style, which Tatars were banned from entering. A cathedral was built and Russians were moved into the city in attempts to make it more Christian. Mosques were banned from being built, though this ban was lifted some 200 years later by Catherine the Great. The fact that a majority of the people in Kazan remain Muslim seems to indicate that Ivan failed. From that day to now, the former Khanate of Kazan remains well within the folds of the Russians. First in the Tsardom of Russia, then in the Russian Empire, then the Soviet Union, and now in the Russian Federation. To the southwest, on the Crimean Peninsula, there was another Tatar Khanate that had appeared out of the ashes of the Golden Horde. Crimea was geopolitically very important to almost all empires nearby, including the ones across the Black Sea in Anatolia. It was the western end of the Silk Road, and its port cities were vital in the trade that existed between China and Europe. Before the Mongol invasions, the peninsula was mainly occupied by Slavs with significant Greek, Armenian, and Jewish minorities. Other than them, there were likely a number of Franks and Italians living in the coastal cities as merchants and sailors connecting this end of the Silk Road to Western Europe. Inland than these merchant colonies, there were various nomadic tribes that often raided the port cities. Like with Volga Bulgaria, these tribes would merge with the Mongols. Crimea was conquered by Batu Khan around 1223, who then sacked and practically leveled the city of Sudak in southeastern Crimea. It was then attacked again by Alauddin, the Seljuk Sultan of Rum. After this, large numbers of Seljuk and Oghuz Turks began moving onto the peninsula during the second half of the 13th century. By the end of that century, Arab travelers report that Sudak was primarily Turkic. However, the rest of the peninsula remained Christian. This movement of people likely came in an attempt to consolidate power over a vital port at this end of the Silk Road. The Tatars were still only in small numbers here and there throughout the southern part of the peninsula. During the Mongol era, Crimea was controlled from the city of Solkhat. It became something of an international metropolitan city, quite like others such as Kaffa, which was primarily Genoese. It was so important to other powers in the region that Sultan Bebrus of Mongol Egypt built a mosque there. It was also the home of many rebels and renegades against the Golden Horde, which would eventually propel Crimea to independence. The man who established the Khanate of Crimea was named Haji Girey. The fact that his name is written in the modern Turkish script shows how much impact the Ottomans would have on the culture of the Khanate. He was likely born in Lithuania and took charge of Crimea around 1441. His biggest enemy wasn't Moscow, rather it was Sarai, due to them considering Crimea a part of the Golden Horde. Every attempt to make Crimea stronger would be met by resistance from Sarai. So initially, he allied with Russia and Poland-Lithuania against the Golden Horde, but in the year 1453, everything changed for Crimea. The trade route that went from Crimea to Western Europe went through a choke point, Constantinople. In 1453, it fell to the Ottomans, who ended the long-declining Byzantine Empire. Since both the Ottomans and the Crimeans benefited from this trade, their interests were aligned. In 1454, with the help of the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed II, Haji Gireh laid siege to Kaffa, the Genoese port city. Kaffa agreed to pay tribute. With this, Haji Gireh had secured most of Crimea, and now he needed more allies. He created policies that made Crimea very attractive to Tatar tribes who lived under the Golden Horde. Various tribes began moving to the newly rising Crimean Khanate and abandoned the declining Golden Horde. Many of these tribes were vital for Golden Horde's defense, and so their move weakened the Horde greatly. Where they strengthened the Khanate of Crimea, they also brought with them the very disease that had weakened the Golden Horde: political factionalism. Many of these new arrivals in Crimea wanted power for themselves and so began plotting against the Khan. They were able to depose Haji Gireh in favor of his son, but he was installed again shortly after. This proved to the Khan that his power was declining. Though into his second reign, he began preparing an attack against the Golden Horde, which never saw completion because he died in 1466. A war of succession broke out between his sons, and the Ottomans intervened, installing Menli Gireh on the throne. From then on, the Ottomans began intervening in Crimean affairs. However, it wasn't that one-sided. Crimeans controlled a large portion of their foreign policy, and the Ottomans treated them more like allies rather than tributaries, although this relationship kept getting more and more lopsided as the Ottomans began appointing Crimean Khans and hence regulating succession. During the peak of the Crimean Khanate, a large number of Circassians also converted to Islam because the Khans had an active military relationship with them. The Khanate hit its peak in 1571 when Devlet Gireh attacked and burned Moscow. Although the Khanate's decline started the very next year, when the Russians defeated them at Malodi. From then to around 1700, the Khanate kept declining. The Ottomans themselves hit their peak in 1683 and started a slow decline, while Russia was, by then, a huge European power. Their influence kept growing in the region. It culminated in the Russo-Turkish War, which ended in 1774. A clause in the treaty established, once again, an independent Crimean Khanate. However, it wasn't all that independent. There were a lot of Russian troops deployed there, which created unrest between pro-Ottoman and pro-Russian forces. The Ottomans didn't really support the pro-Ottomans, but, well, the unrest led to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 1783 under Catherine the Great. From then till the Russian Revolution, Crimea and its Tatars remained a part of the Russian Empire. After that, they were a part of the Soviet Union and suffered, like almost all other minorities, severe oppression alongside other problems such as famines. During the Second World War, Crimea was occupied by the Nazis. Crimean Tatars were playing various roles during this period. Some of them joined the Nazis in a fight against Russia. Some joined the Red Army against the Nazis, while many were forced into labor camps by the Nazis. After the war, Stalin saw the Crimean Tatars and many other minorities as traitors to Russia and so began deporting them. Around 200,000 to 250,000 Crimean Tatars were deported throughout the Soviet Union, with many being sent to Uzbekistan. They were packed into trains and sent to camps where they were little more than slave labor. Around a fourth of the deported Crimean Tatars died. Crimean culture and identity were also attacked by Stalin. They kept fighting for their rights with little to no support, or in many instances with little to no recognition by the world, especially the West. Finally, in 1989, in Mikhail Gorbachev's government, the Crimean Tatars were allowed to return to Crimea, but obviously their properties had been seized by Stalin, and so many who returned had to rebuild their lives there. They were inherited by Ukraine in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union. With Russia's occupation of Crimea in 2014, the Crimean Tatars once again found themselves living under the Russians. While the Volga and Crimean Tatars are the largest groups of Tatars, they are by no means the only ones. There are Astrakhan Tatars, who themselves created a small Khanate that lasted around a century from the 1460s to the 1550s. It had a tumultuous relationship with the Crimean Khanate and the Russians. The latter conquered it in 1556. To the west, in the lands of the former Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, there are the Lipka Tatars. Quite early on in the history of Poland-Lithuania, the Lipka Tatars became a vital part of their military and even rose up to join the nobility. But eventually, they lost their religious and ethnic rights, which led to them rebelling in the famous Lipka Rebellion, which was supported by the Ottoman Empire. Eventually, the Lipka rebels rejoined Poland-Lithuania's military. They even fought against the Ottomans in the siege of Vienna in 1683 and were critical to breaking the Ottoman siege. Today, they live in parts of Poland and Belarus. Various other small groups of Muslim Tatars are found throughout the area of the former Soviet Union. Some of them have rather fully been Russianized, while some of them stick to their Tatar identities. As minorities, most of them suffered from famines and oppression during the Soviet era, but to different degrees. For example, the Volga Tatars are mostly at peace with the Russians today, while the Crimean Tatars aren't. The Tatars are, of course, by no means a single people. While they have the same origins, they have diverged from each other, and many groups today share nothing more than their names. Even their adherence to Islam varies from group to group. Due to their shamanistic roots and depending on their relations with other Muslim powers, some groups of Tatars never really adhered to Islam, while others did. Even today, depending on how much they've taken from their country's customs, some call themselves Muslims just in name, while some continue to stick to their religious identities and practices. Nothing makes us cling to our identity like oppression, and so the most oppressed group of Tatars stick to their identity more than the rest. See you next time. Don't forget to subscribe and press the bell icon. On the screen right now, you can see the names and tiers of the patrons. You can join them by pledging a dollar or more to support the channel. Thank you for watching.